Hello, everyone. I'm Sam.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Mo.
And this is Team Get Over It.
We're an all-female team participating in the greatest motoring adventure on the planet, the Mongol Rally.
We'll be driving 10,000 miles across mountains, deserts, and unknown terrain.
And along the way, we hope to spread our feminist and environmental ideals.
Join us here as we share our stories, thoughts, and interviews as we get ready for the Mongol Rally 2021.
Don't you mean 2022?
Shit!
Hello, everyone.
Welcome back.
Hey.
We are super stoked, as always, for our episode today because it is going to be a true, I was going to say zinger, but I think that's like that's a negative thing, isn't it?
No, zingers are just like funny jokes that just get you. You're like, haha, ouch.
Okay, it's not a joke. It's going to be a really great episode. And the reason for that is because each of us has researched and written up the narrative of three kick-ass women from history that you might not know about. And so we're going to sort of tell you about them. And it should be an interesting episode. Hopefully you learn something.
I guess I think the idea for this episode came about because I think that like in our history books, I'm sure you all know we've heard a lot about the men in history, history, you know, but we want to tell her story. So,
hey, man, the women make up half of the population. Therefore, there have to be an equal amount of awesome women out there as to the men that we have been force fed over the years. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
I'm super excited to talk about these amazing women. The woman who I researched, I actually didn't know, like, I knew about her, but I didn't know about her specifically. Like, I knew about the movement that she was a part of, and because I had done a little bit of research about it in one of my classes I took in college. So yay for recycling books that I kept from university. Oh, yeah.
We support recycling.
Yes, we do.
That's very true. Okay, so without further ado, we're going to introduce our first story. I'm going to go first. So my story, she is a Canadian person, and it's kind of interesting because a lot of people don't think that Canada has this kind of history or these kinds of problems, but we do. We just kind of keep it buried, but I think it's really important to talk about it and kind of put it in perspective. So the person I'm going to talk about is Viola Desmond. So kind of like what Mo was saying, like I had heard about her before because in 2018, when I was not living in Canada at the time, I was living in Korea, but she was put on our $10 bill. And I was kind of wondering about her. And I was like, well, you know, why is she such an important person and what did she do? So I wanted to talk about her and on this episode and then also do some research for myself. So I'll begin. Viola Desmond was born July 6, 1914 in Halifax, Canada. She was one of 11 children born to her parents, James and Gwendolyn Davis. Mr. and Mrs. Davis were accepted and well-respected in their community, even though Mr. Davis was a black man and Mrs. Davis was a white woman.
I can see where this is going.
Yeah, it's interesting. Interracial marriages being uncommon at the time. So it was kind of like a really special thing, I guess, or anyway. So inspired by her parents, Desmond was determined to become an independent businesswoman. She eventually enrolled at the Field Beauty School in Montreal and beauty schools in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and New York. She needed to travel outside of her hometown to learn because at the time, schools in Halifax did not accept black students.
Oh, wow.
When was this?
This was, well, I guess this must have been when she was like 18. So like maybe 1930-ish or like a little bit, yeah, around 1930 something.
Not totally unexpected for that time period. So yeah, okay.
Not unexpected for that time period, but like I remember sitting, I think it was one of the Thanksgivings that we went to with like Warren and the hiking group. Mm-hmm. And I remember a lot of people were talking about racism at one of the tables. And then I was the only Canadian at the table and somebody turned to me and said, oh, you must feel really left out of this conversation. So I think that there's like this general consensus or this kind of myth that there wasn't segregation or there isn't this kind of racism in Canada, but
right.
we have a lot of racism in Canada actually. So anyway, it was one of the reasons why I chose this story. So the reason why she wanted to study cosmetology is because she noticed that there was a severe lack of beauty services available to Black people. So when she finished her study, she returned to Halifax and opened Vi's Studio of Beauty Culture. After some time, she also opened her own beauty school, the Desmond School of Beauty Culture. Through the school, Desmond was able to help other Black women in her community to become economically independent and successful by making skills learning more easily accessible. She also launched her own beauty product line designed for Black women that graduates of her school could sell at their own beauty parlors. Nice. Viola Desmond didn't just help others to start their own businesses, but she also encouraged women in the Black community to put their best selves forward and face the world with confidence and style.
I love that. That's amazing. It seems like she had a real lasting and meaningful impact.
Yeah, I'd say so, for sure. So though many believe Canada to be the land free of racist thoughts and policies of its southern neighbor, that is and was simply not the case. Perhaps racism wasn't as overt in Canada as it was in the U.S., but Black Canadians were still not awarded the same rights, freedoms, or status as white Canadians. For example, Black Canadians were not permitted to join the regular corps in the army during World War I. They had to join a special division that dealt exclusively with construction and maintenance. This marginally improved during World War II, but Black Canadians still faced discrimination in the army by being denied certain roles and promotions, as they were at the mercy of white and often racist commanding officers. And I mean, and that's just to put it into perspective a little bit. There's also a lot of, especially against like Indigenous people, like if we talk about like the 60s scoop, for example, where a lot of like white doctors, like in white hospitals, were literally like scooping up babies as they were being born of Indigenous parents and kind of like taking the baby away. And like for some women, like they would wake up or like maybe they passed out or something, or the doctors would say like, oh, your baby, we're going to take it to another room quickly. And they'll ask for their baby later, be like, where's my baby? And they're like, oh, it died. But it actually didn't die, that they were just putting the babies in like orphanages or like adopting them out into white families to kind of like get rid of Indigenous culture. It's terrible. So that was, anyway, that was like one thing that happened. We also had residential schools and like a lot of like, you know, institutionalized racism, discrimination that endure until this day. A lot of people don't know about that, but it's very shocking.
It's amazing how much Canada kind of parallels and or like has similar issues that the U.S. has that nobody recognizes and or talks about.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that happened, like a lot of like a lot of wars, I guess, and a lot of decisions and a lot of like kind of like cultural progress or like cultural happenings or whatever. It's like, you know, the America did it first and then Canada did it, or not usually vice versa, actually, to be perfectly honest. But I think like Canada is like Canada is very much influenced by America, for sure. It happens a lot. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so on November 8th, 1946, so here we're 1946, Desmond was on her way to Sydney, Nova Scotia. So Sydney, Nova Scotia is like in the northern part, like the northeastern part of Nova Scotia, for a business meeting when her car broke down. She was in the town of New Glasgow and took her car to a mechanic to have it fixed. It was going to take a few hours for the repairs, so Desmond decided to watch a movie while waiting. She made her way over to the Roseland Theater and asked for a seat in the main seating area. Obviously like kind of like front and center so you can actually see what's going on the screen. When she entered the theater, the usher informed her that her ticket was for the balcony instead. Up in the nosebleeds.
Okay.
Is this like
yes
segregated seating situation?
So thinking there had been a mistake, she returned to the ticket seller to get the correct ticket. But when she explained the situation to the seller, they said, I'm sorry, but I'm not permitted to sell downstairs tickets to you people.
Oh my God.
So understandably, Desmond decided to sit on the main floor regardless of what the staff had told her or what her ticket said.
Good for her.
So the manager, Henry McNeil, which is like the whitest name I've ever heard, approached her and argued that the theater could refuse admission to any objectionable person, implying that she is objectionable. Desmond replied that she had not refused or had not been refused, but she was just sold the wrong ticket. So she offered to pay the difference in price, but she refused to move from her seat in the main floor of the theater. Reasonable. So a police officer was called and Desmond was dragged from the theater, being injured in the process.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so she was charged with trying to defraud the provincial government for allegedly refusing to pay a 1 cent amusement tax, which would have been the difference between the balcony and the main floor tickets, which she offered to pay. Yeah, she was ordered to pay $26 to the manager of the Roseland Theater. McNeil? Yeah, by the judge in the case. She did not have any representation during the trial, nor was she told she was entitled to any.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's messed up.
There was also no Crown prosecutor present, as McNeil represented himself.
Is that legal?
I don't think so. It certainly isn't now. It might have been then, but they were taking advantage of the situation. And they didn't want to go 100%. Through the effort of like finding all these people and giving her due process. But it's definitely because like she's a minority, right? It's because she's Black and she's being taken advantage of. It's terrible.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't disagree at all. Like,
yeah. It's awful.
It irritates the crap out of me when people don't go through the effort of, you know, doing it the right way. And they're just like, we'll just kind of, you know, fudge it a little bit. It'll be fine. It's like, no, it's not going to be fine. You're just completely messing with somebody's life.
Yeah. And I think this kind of case, even though this happened in the 40s, I think it mirrors a lot of cases like that are happening now, especially in the United States, because like, you know, disproportionately, like, you know, African Americans, Black people are in jail. And a lot of that has to do with like the court system.
Yeah.
Because they take the plea bargains. And a lot of times too, like, especially if you're from like a lower income bracket, then you wouldn't be able to afford your own representation. You're supposed to get state representation, but state attorneys, like defense attorneys, often don't have time. Like, I think I heard a statistic one time that they have an average of 7 minutes per case.
Yeah, I remember because hearing that as well.
Right, so they don't have time.
They have a butt ton of cases that they have to deal with on a regular basis. So, you know, you're just one of the 100 that they're dealing with as you're getting through. So like, you don't get the time that you need and you don't get the proper representation that you need.
Yeah. So they're just like, okay, like put lawyer, it through, but... put it through. And it, like, I mean, it's surprisingly similar, even though like, you know, we think we've made progress since then. Actually, I don't know if we've really made any progress at all, but anyway, so continuing on, when interviewed by the Toronto Daily Star, McNeil said that there wasn't an explicit rule at the theater banning Black people from sitting on the main floor, but it was customary. So all this for something that's just customary? Okay, buddy. Carrie Best, the founder of the Black newspaper, The Clarion, heard about Desmond's experience and became particularly interested in the story, as she had a similar experience a few years before. In Best's case, she filed a civil suit against the theater and lost. Desmond, this time with legal representation, also tried to file a suit against the theater for unlawfully ejecting her from the theater. The judge of the case ruled that she should have appealed the original ruling at the county court, and since the window of the appeal had already passed, her case was dismissed.
Sure, get her on a technicality, like a tool, my goodness.
If that's even true, like, it could just be it doesn't sound correct in my case.
That sounds sus to me.
Right, this is super sus. I think they're just being dumb. Well, they're not being dumb, they're being racist.
Right, yeah. They're making it as difficult as possible for her to follow the rules, follow the protocols to, you know, represent herself properly.
Yeah.
And not be forced to pay dues that she undeservedly was forced to pay.
Yes.
Because they don't want to have to deal with her.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that just happens a lot.
It happens a lot. Like, they kind of intentionally make things difficult to discourage people from, like, doing what they need to do or getting what they need to get. Ugh, it's terrible. It's awful.
It's institutionalized racism.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So, though she lost her case, the support that she received from the Black community in Nova Scotia was indicative of social change. The fight continued and segregation officially ended in 1954, surprisingly. And like, before I researched this, I had no idea that we even had like an official segregation in Canada. But we
really?
Yeah, I had no idea, but we did. Yeah, and it ended in 1954. That's crazy. So in 2010, Viola Desmond was granted a pardon by the Lieutenant Governor of Nova Scotia, kind of like a governor, I guess, if you're American and listening. Right. And she received a public apology from the Premier. So in 2012, Canada Post made a stamp featuring Desmond, and in 2018, she was selected to appear on the $10 Canadian banknote. Viola Desmond passed away in 1965 and unfortunately wasn't able to see all these changes herself. She does have a surviving sister who took it upon herself to spread Viola's story and create awareness for the plight of Black Canadians. It's largely thanks to her that we know about Desmond's courage and perseverance today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good on the sister. Yay.
Yeah. And like, I think, and I saw a video of her being shown the $10 banknote and like, she was in tears. Like, you know, it's such a, cause like, I mean, she saw the struggle. She lived through it. She saw what happened to her sister. And then like to see her kind of immortalized on currency like that, I'm sure it must've been like really something. Anyway, really impactful for sure.
Is she still on the banknote?
I wonder about that. I don't think it was a permanent thing. I feel like it was a limited run. But don't quote me on that. I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's good. Because, like, up until now, the only female that we've had on any of our currency has been the queen. So.
Yeah.
Which is, like, totally.
And she's not even from your country.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Canada's like this weird middle ground.
I mean, Canada's Commonwealth, yes. I guess.
She's our head of state, but yeah, but you're right. I mean, like, you're right though. Like, I mean, the Queen has these days anyway has very little to do with our country. So it would be nice. It would be nice to have like bona fide like Canadians who have like contributed to Canada on our currency. But
yeah.
Yeah. We'll see what happens in the future.
Yeah, like it would be cool to have Desmond on the banknote permanently.
Yeah. And there was a lot of, there was another lady that was being discussed, and I forget who it was, but she was also, was it like a doctor? Maybe? I think it was somebody who got into the medical field, like when most women were not accepted into medicine, but I forget who it was. That would be like another excellent person to research. But yeah, it was really cool. So anyway, that's it for me. Nice. I finished.
Yay. I mean, not yay that you finished, but like, yay, because it was amazing.
Yeah, woo! No, that was, I'm really glad that I know about Viola Desmond now. Desmond.
Yeah, me too. Yep. Same.
I'm curious. I mean, because I guess, I mean, you grew up in the Canadian educational system.
Right.
Was Desmond ever in any history book?
Never talked about, never. And I think, the only, yeah, and even like in like even things like I was talking about like the 60s scoop and like the residential schools and stuff was only something that I learned about recently. We never, it's sort of glossed over a lot of cases, that kind of stuff. Even like Indigenous people in general, like whenever I remember learning about Indigenous people, because like the thing with Canadian history is very region specific. So in my region, our main Indigenous group is called the Mi'kmaq. And then so what I learned about the Mi'kmaq is like, oh, the Mi'kmaq are really friendly people, and they helped like settlers settle in to the country and like showed them how to survive in winter, and that was it. Like, I didn't hear anything about like murders or wars or genocide. I didn't hear about any of that kind of stuff until I was like older, you know, much later. But a person that I know that I worked with, so she's from Manitoba, and Manitoba's history is a little bit different. And so they, like, in Manitoba, I think Indigenous populations like Mi'tsi make up a pretty large percentage of the total population. So their history books are a little bit different, and they kind of focused on more of the conflicts between like Indigenous populations and white settlers. And they kind of like painted it in a more like, you know, what happened to the Indigenous people was not fair. So it's interesting. So it kind of depends which region that you're from, but like, again, and I think I learned about that a little bit. I remember, but it was like a chapter, like it wasn't really in depth, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And like Viola Desmond's from Nova Scotia. I'm from Prince Edward Island. That's right next door. And I'd never heard of her before until a couple of years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Who's up next? Who wants to share?
Well, if we're going in alphabetical order, M comes next.
All right, Mo, you're up.
All right, so I decided to do my research on a Japanese woman who was very influential in the birth control and women's rights in Japan.
Ooh.
And
oh, cool.
Her name is Shizuka Kato, but she originally started off as Shizuka Ishimoto because she remarried about midway through her life.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And she's actually referred to as Baroness Shizuka Ishimoto. And she was the first woman to actually get into the Diet, I think, which is the lower house in the Japanese government.
Oh, okay.
And wow, like the 1940s. Cool. So she was like one of the first women to get a seat in that area. And while she was there working in the lower area, in the lower house, she worked to try to like fix the eugenics law that they have in, that Japan had in place, which kind of, you know, pushed abortions illegal, but also pushed women to be patriotic because it was a very militarized mindset at the time. Mm-hmm. Was that if a woman was going to be patriotic, her job was to have many, many, many children. More boys so that they could go into the military and be part of the war machine and things like that. And so there's a really strong push for people to have children, whether they wanted them or not.
When was this
and
again?
And so she really, about 1940s, 1930s, okay, that area. So she got into the lower house towards the end of the 1930s and beginning of the 1940s. So in that time period, she got into the house, was like pushing for the eugenic laws to get changed and to have them focus more on birth control and family planning. So focus more on like, you know, deciding when do you want to have kids? How many kids do you and your husband plan to have or want to have? How many can you actually afford to have? And a lot of that was based on her personal experience of living in a mining community when she was married to her first husband when she was quite young, and you know, dealing with and having interactions with the women who worked in the mines and seeing the conditions that they lived in and the conditions that they were raising their children in and the things that they struggled and suffered with, which I read about in her lovely book called Facing Two Ways. And she wrote her own autobiography, which she published in 1937-38, somewhere in that area.
So how old would she have been when she wrote this?
So she was born in 1897. So she's probably in her mid-30s when she wrote that book. 30s, 40s, probably closer to 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so she was very influenced by the suffrage movement leader in the U.S., Sanger.
Hmm.
But she actually went to New York and met Margaret Sanger in New York in the 1920s and became a really big advocate for women's rights and women's health and family planning. And she took all of that and everything that she learned from Sanger back to Japan and really pushed for clinics to be open, for, you know, informational pop-up shops to happen in Japan. And she actually opened her first birth control clinic in Tokyo in 1933.
Wow. So, nice.
She opened her own clinic and she was, you know, really working hard to try and promote birth control and preventative care and just general, like, overall well-being for women's health in Japan at the time. And unfortunately, in the late 1930s, 1940s, it really kind of got shut down due to the war effort and all of that and patriotism. It was seen as her push for those things for family planning was seen as very unpatriotic. And so a lot of people were very against it and they shut it down. And for a while, there was a lot of stigmatism against birth control. They saw it as being like something that only prostitutes would take to prevent, you know, getting pregnant while they're doing their work and things like that. And so a lot of people were just misinformed about the products, what it's used for and like how it could help them.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a like negative stigma surrounding birth control.
Yes, there was very much so. And a lot of that was due to the propaganda of the Japanese patriotism at the time and the patriarchy and all of that fun stuff. And but yeah, so when she wrote her book, she wasn't quite yet in the Diet. This is after she had opened her first clinic. And it kind of goes over, she does spend like two chapters very briefly at the end talking about feminism in Japan, like the history of feminism and her views in relationship with it.
Mm.
And she kind of goes over how she's struggled with trying to, you know, dealing with those issues. And in 1948, abortion was they changed the eugenics protection law in 1948 and made it so that abortion was legalized, but for very specific reasons. But before that, abortion was just like completely legal. So there were plenty of women who were suffering and or potentially passing away from botched abortions and things like that, mm-hmm. and just trying to take care of it themselves because they couldn't handle the burden or whatever the reason may be. So in 1949, she loses her seat in the lower house due to some of the political ramifications of her standpoint of, like, you know, abortions and women's health and everything like that. But she still continued to run her clinics. She handed out pamphlets and ran informational centers and just to kind of help get the word out to the public and, you know, help people, you know, really
spread awareness,
break that stigmatism and spread awareness. Yes, essentially. Yeah. And in the following year, 1950, she actually gained a seat in the upper house. So basically she went from like the House of Representatives to the Senate, essentially, if you were like comparing it to the U.S. kind of. So she went from like the lower house to the upper house.
Is it comparable? Like, is
kind of
okay.
Like vaguely comparable.
Okay, we don't have to get into like a governmental lesson right now.
And even my Japanese government is just kind of like a little shaky as well. But like, that's just kind of how I easily compare it, just so that I can keep track of like the importance of it. Yeah. So basically, when she gains her seat in the upper house, she continues to push her programming of, you know, parent plan or family planning and birth control. And she actually ends up opening up the first Japanese Family Federation, which is a clinic that pushes all that information in 1954. And then in 1955, they have the 5th International Family Planning Conference in Tokyo. And she, participated in that as well.
Cool.
So she did a lot of really amazing things, and even up until her death in 2001, she was continued to be viewed in Japan as a very highly regarded individual, and played a key role in the change of mindset of people in Japan from, you know, the proper family size being four or more children to, you know, one child. Or like around 1 to 2 kids, which has kind of has like Japan has swung very, very far from the giant population growth to a minimal population growth, and that unfortunately has caused a lot of problems, or is beginning to cause a lot of problems now as the larger population body is aging out of a lot of jobs in a lot of areas and is now has nobody to support them because they don't have, 12 grandchildren to help look after them or, you know, provide them with financial assistance if they need it or anything like that.
But it sounds like she really helped bring a lot of women autonomy over their bodies and their reproductive decisions and having the ability to make the choice, like, how many kids do I want? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, and that also had a cascading effect to the workforce. So women didn't feel like they had to get married immediately and be the housewife who raised the kids, took care of the kids, took care of the family. Women, because they had more autonomy over their bodies, also had the ability to, you know, go out and get that education, go out and pursue a career in whatever field they chose, and have more flexibility with where they fell in the social hierarchy of the country. And they weren't just limited to, well, your husband does this job, and so you're viewed a certain way.
Yeah.
Right.
Like it was previously.
And I feel, too, that, like, because recently last summer, it was somebody, I think, on the Olympic Committee. This older man was, or like somebody had suggested that they should get more women on the committee. And then he made a comment about if there's more women on the committee, we're never going to get any work done because all they will do is talk.
Ha! rude.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly. And then this statement went public, and which really indicated to me like how, like from, I guess, like from the olden times, like until now, how public opinion and like public acceptance of those kinds of comments or even that way of thinking has mm-hmm. changed a lot. So, you know, he said the statement, of course, I assume like because he said it, he didn't really see any problem with it, but there was a huge public outcry against it. And, you know, many people were like, you can't say these things. Like it's, you know, it's outdated, it's sexist, it's wrong. And he was forced to resign his position on the council. And I
not,
was like,
not overly surprised by that.
I hope they replaced him with a woman.
Oh yeah. That'd be hilarious. So yeah. I mean, I can totally understand like the impact that she had, and it's amazing to see how tenacious she was. Like she started pushing and started trying to, you know, get really into women's rights back in the 1920s. And she didn't stop and she didn't give up on it at all, even up until passing in 2001.
So like, she was like 104?
Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
But yeah, great. So that was my awesome lady who was a pioneer in women's rights in Japan.
I'm curious, and I don't know if you know this, Mo, but I guess what was the progression of the women's rights movement in Japan? Like, when did it start? Like, I guess.
It started in 1920 when she,
okay,
know,
so she really was, like, one was, of the, like, yeah, at the she, forefront she was, as a pioneer of this
oh,
movement.
Oh, yeah. She literally went to the U.S. in the 1920s and met Margaret Sanger, who was one of the major suffrage women in the U.S. at the time. Talked to her, got very inspired by her, and brought a lot of the ideals back to Japan. But focused a lot on birth control and family planning. Like those were her two big points. And from that point forward, she kept doing things, but in the 1930s, it was kind of suppressed a little bit, but it really picked up when she got into the upper house in the 1950s. And from that point forward, it just kind of took off.
And that's pretty interesting. Yeah. Cause Margaret Sanger is also the person who founded Planned Parenthood, and I think and I think she was kind of the person who pushed for the invention of like the birth control pill.
Really?
Yeah. It says like the inventors are men, of course they do, but I'm pretty sure she pushed for it and she funded it, if I'm not mistaken.
I would not be surprised in the least that like she seemed like one of those boss ass individuals that should be like, you're going to do this thing for me, whether you like it or not. Here's the money.
It would be really interesting, and maybe we can do this in a future episode, to explore the history and the creation of birth control, because I know so little about it, and it's something that I think is so prevalent and sort of like ubiquitous in so many women's lives. So
I think like birth control and family planning in general has like a super long history across many different cultures. Like I know a lot of people think it's something modern that was just invented like a little while ago, but it's not. And I totally agree with that. I've been learning a little bit about it recently just through like random podcasts and books, etc. And I think that would be that's a great idea.
Well, and birth control has, you know, different effects on different people. Like, you know, we could all three of us could take the same birth control and all have different reactions to it and different and have it affect us in different ways. And it's just, it's still very, I feel it's still very kind of like experimental kind of.
there definitely like, is like a level of guesswork in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
True.
Especially since they keep coming out with the new types of birth control or like different variations on the what's already there. They're like, hey, you like the Nova Ring? Let's, you know, make a different one and we'll call it something else. But it's just literally the same thing, but we're gonna be like, it's new, yay. Slap some shiny packaging on it and be like, it's new and shiny. You want this thing, right?
Yeah. So
anyways. That's my spiel.
Okay, well, that was a good spiel.
Last up?
Yeah, last up. Okay, so I guess to wrap up this episode, I'm actually really excited to share about the woman I chose because I think she is sort of the embodiment of our team's ethos in terms of just being like a badass adventuring feminist. Cool. And so the woman I chose to do my research on is actually the first woman to ever successfully summit Mount Everest.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Nice.
And Mo, she actually came from Japan as well. So we have two Japan feminists in the podcast.
Woo-hoo, go Japan.
Yeah. And it's interesting. She was around during the same time period. So as you were talking, I was like, oh, this is really like I was sort of thinking about like the potential overlaps.
Yeah.
So the person I researched is Junko Tabe, who was, as I said, the first woman to successfully summit Mount Everest. And she is basically, I think, one of the most famous female mountaineers in history and arguably maybe one of the most successful. But she's also very important in the environmental activism around climbers in the climbing community.
So
Junko Tabe was born in 1939 in Miharu, Fukushima in Japan. She was one of seven children, and growing up she was often described as frail and sickly, and so when she actually initially took to climbing, a lot of her neighbors and friends described that they were surprised because they didn't think she had the stamina for it. But she took to it like a, what's the expression, like a fish takes to water.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
And it really became sort of the thing in her life that would light her up and give her drive and passion throughout the rest of her life.
Cool.
So where she lived in Japan, and actually, Mo, you might be able to speak on this because have you been, I mean, I know you've been to Japan, but have you been to Fukushima?
I want to say yes. Oh, yeah. No, me and Jess went to Fukushima, I think, for summer vacation one year.
You went to Fukuoka.
Oh, you get to Fukuoka. Ah, dang it. Okay. You're right. Sorry.
Never mind.
I'm terrible. I can't remember where all the provinces are. You'll have to forgive me.
Okay. Well, anyways, so in Fukushima.
Sorry.
Where she
Fukushima,
lived,
Fukuoka.
it was more rural, and they weren't located close to any major cities, and so as a result she actually spent her childhood in a very sort of like nature-centered setting. She was surrounded by nature at all times, and so when she was 10, her school teacher took the students on a climbing trip to a nearby mountain in northern Japan called Nasudake, and this is where she first fell in love with climbing. They carried everything with them, camped out overnight, and climbed to the top. And there's this quote in her memoir where she describes sort of the initial experience of reaching her first summit. And she says, "There I was treated to a view from the top that was unlike anything I had ever seen. I was much higher up than the mountains that surrounded my home. It triggered an awareness that there were many things in the world for me to discover." And this was really a pivotal moment for Junko. It was when sort of like that fire was lit in her and her love of climbing and hiking began. So throughout her childhood, she only went on a few more hiking trips because it was sort of a costly activity and her family didn't have the money
for it. Especially if they're heading that far north.
Yeah. But nature remained this really important place of respite for her and where she would go to recharge. So Junko was actually lucky growing up because her father put a huge emphasis on education for his children, even for his daughters, which wasn't the norm at the time. And so where she lived in Miharu in the 1930s, it was common for kids to really only go to school through middle school. But Junko actually went all the way to university and actually attended Showa Women's University in Tokyo, where she studied English and American literature.
Nice. That's actually a really great university in Japan. Like a lot of people try to get into Japan, get into Showa even today, and it's very competitive.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I mean, obviously to go to Showa, she had to move to Tokyo, but she had a hard time adjusting to the big city after living mostly surrounded by nature for the majority of her life. And so while in university, she actually suffered from depression. And at one point, her father actually encouraged her to take a break from school, and he told her to go spend some time in nature. And so that's what she did.
Wow. That's also pretty forward thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Her father was awesome. So
she, very supportive guy.
Yeah, he really was. So she spent time hiking, regained some of her strength, and found that it provided her with some much needed relief. And so when Junko returned to university, eventually she continued to spend time outdoors, and she bought a book about the mountains all around Tokyo and would spend most of her weekends climbing, which I thought we would all appreciate because that's basically what we did.
And how- Literally every weekend.
I went hiking. Yeah, I went hiking on Sunday and Saturday. I went hiking twice this weekend, actually.
Well, there's a quote that you would love. I'm not going to get it exactly, but in her memoir, she says something about like, I loathe the idea of spending a Sunday idly at home rather than being on a mountain. And I think you would appreciate that, Caitlin.
Yes. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah.
God, yes. I agree with that so much.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So she spent most of her weekends climbing and she actually joined a student hiking group, which I also thought we would appreciate because we met in a hiking group. And she... basically, climbing sort of became her life. She says in her memoir that she became excited, happy with planning her next climb. And that was sort of like what gave her purpose throughout the week, was sort of like going, like, what's going to be the next climb to plan and living for those climbs. So after graduating from college, she initially intended to become a teacher. And I can't remember the reason why she changed her mind, but she decided not to do that. She ended up later going into editing for a physical education journal, I want to say. I could be wrong.
Interesting.
But basically, after graduation, from there on out, her life revolved around climbing. So she joined a woman's climbing club and began to learn how to do rock climbing and new methods of mountaineering. And this is where she was first introduced to ice climbing, which becomes important when she then goes on to summit Everest.
Right.
So... yeah, so for a while she was in a woman's climbing club, but she eventually joined the Ryoho Climbing Club, which was a different club dedicated to sort of cutting edge climbing. And I think they may have gone on sort of more adventurous expeditions and done more technically difficult climbs, which as an experienced climber was what she was looking for. But she was one of only a few female climbers who were members at the time. And she received actually a lot of pushback for this because... A lot of the male climbers viewed women as, quote, too weak to complete climbs. And so they actually often barred them from participating in trips, saying that they would either hold them back or be a detriment and put everyone else in danger.
Well, that's a bunch of bullshit if I ever heard bullshit.
Yeah, well, I know, right?
That was the thing. Junko called bullshit too. She wrote at one point, she said, despite my hard-earned competency in the mountains, I sometimes felt other male climbers gave me the once over at the crags while saying, this is no place for a woman. My commitment was to climbing, here's the quote, and I loathe the idea of having to spend a Sunday sitting idle rather than being on a mountain.
Atta girl.
Get it.
So she continued to climb despite the resistance. And in 1964, she actually met her husband while climbing.
Aww.
I know. I love this story. So she met her husband, Masanobu Tabe, while on a hike. And the way she tells it, she climbed to the top of the mountain with a friend of hers. And he was at the top already. And he had made all these little desserts for the group for everyone to enjoy at the end. And she said the first date was on the mountain.
Oh my God, that's so romantic.
Isn't it? So
good.
I love it.
Oh my God.
And he actually... he's awesome too, just like her father. He really is like a stand-up figure in her life. They ended up marrying 2 years later and they had 2 children together, a son and a daughter. But he really took on the majority of the housework and the domestic load. So he put sort of, I guess he didn't let the gender stereotypes, because what is this? This is the 1960s in Japan. And so there was this huge push for sort of her to be the homemaker of the family, but he actually did a lot of that for her. And so he took care of the kids, he cooked the meals, and he really let her go out and do all of her climbing and adventuring and be sort of the quote-unquote climber in their relationship.
Wow. That's fabulous.
Yeah, and he continued to support her throughout the rest of her career.
Cool.
So in 1969, Junko was contacted by another relatively well-known female climber at the time, Yoshiko Wakayama, who was actually part of the first female ascent on the north face of Matterhorn.
Wow. Oh, okay.
So Yoshiko,
another difficult climb.
Yeah. Yoshiko told Junko that she was seeking out experienced climbers in Japan to be part of a women's only climbing group in the Himalayas.
Nice.
And so the two of them formed this women's only climbing team that would later make the ascension of Mount Everest that put Junko on the map as the first woman to summit Everest.
That's nice. Fabulous. Mm-hmm.
That's really awesome.
So the two of them form this team of all badass female climbers in Japan. And their first climb was Annapurna 3, which is part of the Annapurna mountain range in Nepal and sits at around like a little under 25,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And they use this expedition sort of as like a way to answer for themselves and for everyone else. Like, can we do this? Can we successfully pull together a team of all women and climb in the Himalayas? And the answer was a resounding yes. They were more than successful, and they basically came off the mountain. And the first thing they did was say, we want to climb Everest now. They like turned their sights to Everest, and they were like, that's where we're going. So a year
they're
later,
like, training episode done.
Yeah, they're sorry. Like, yeah. They're like, that's our warm up. We're just gonna casually right, go right. And second hike out the biggest peak.
We're just gonna crush fabulous. Everest. Don't mind us.
So a year later, in 1970, the team they applied for their permits.
Oh, right.
Because, I mean, even then you needed permits to climb Everest, but they were actually initially declined. And the, I guess, whoever was handing out permits, the greater powers at B, if you will, basically said, oh, like, why don't you do this mountain instead? And offered them a lower mountain and a less difficult mountain, implying that the team wasn't qualified for Everest. but the team said no.
For shame.
They were like, good. We want to climb Everest. That's what we're applying for our permit. Please let us climb Everest. And the government said, okay, well, if you're not going to do another mountain, then you're not climbing any mountain at all.
What the heck? Mm-hmm.
So the team said, okay, fine. And they were like, we're just going to keep applying. And that's what they did. And so 2 years later, they finally had their permit accepted. And so in 1972, their 14-woman climbing team was given a permit for 1975.
Mm-hmm.
So they spent the following years preparing for the trip. It's actually pretty interesting because at the time, and I think even still now, most Everest climbs are funded by sponsors, but their team had a really hard time finding sponsorships. And so the woman in the team actually raised most of the money themselves. I know Junko took odd jobs here and there. She, I think, taught piano and tutored to local students. And most of the women made their equipment. So most of the equipment that this team brought, like their sleeping bags, their tents, were all made from sort of scrap material that they had around their houses.
Holy crap. That's intense.
Wow. Yeah. Yikes. So they did end up getting two last minute sponsors, which I think were two banks. It wasn't a lot of money, and Junko later decided, like, for the rest of her climbing career that she would never take sponsorships again. So I don't really know what went down with that, but
nothing good.
Nothing good. The cool thing is that, like, I mean, these 14 women basically self-funded their way to Everest.
That's so cool.
So
and made their own gear. Like, that's super boss.
Yeah, isn't
I'm
it?
Impressed. Yeah.
So in 1974, a year before their attempt on Everest, the team did a training trip in Gakidake, a mountain in Japan. And Junko describes sort of like what she saw on her expedition in her memoir. She says, on a snowy day, we broke trail in knee-deep powder the entire way from the train station to the mountain summit. There, I finally witnessed what the team had to offer, 13 women setting a solid pace uphill with no complaints. A renewed strength bubbled up and filled my entire body, convincing me that, yes, we would achieve our goal on Everest. I often drew from that feeling of that day to get us to the summit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Walking through knee-deep snow on, like, a flat plain is hard enough. Like, going, like, trucking up a mountain would be... It takes incredible strength and even like mental fortitude to do that.
Mm-hmm. And to not complain. So after years of discrimination because of their gender, the team was finally going to get to prove that they were capable of this climb. And in April of 1975, they began their ascent of Everest. And so when they actually started this climb, it's recorded in their journals that they were all really, really worried because 5 years previously in 1970, there had been a really sort of disastrous and unsuccessful attempt on Everest led by a Japanese team of male climbers in which 8 people had died on the mountain. And so this was very much on their minds when they began the climb. And Junko describes in her memoir how they prayed and they did ceremonies before starting their climb. And she writes, I added my own silent prayer. Please let us maintain the same number of people on the way up and on the way down. And may success on the summit also be granted. And so Junko, as one of the two team leaders of this trip, took safety of her team very seriously. And that's something that all of her team members have later attested to, that she was sort of the rock of the team, and that she made sure that above all else, above even a successful summit, that everyone was safe. So on April 3rd, the team successfully passed the dangerous Khumbu Icefall and set up their first camp on the mountain. And then on April 8th, the team set up their second camp. And this is sort of where it gets interesting in their journey up Everest, because when they actually initially approached the second camp location, their Sherpas showed them where the previous year's teams had set up camp, and the entire team was just distraught with how much trash was left.
Oh.
And so what they ended up doing is they moved their second camp about 15 meters away from this sort of like trash pile, if you will, and decided they would set up their tents there because they didn't want to be surrounded
on
by
top
all
of
this garbage.
Trash.
Yeah. So they set up their tents or their second camp there. And then as the team worked to establish routes to camps 3 and 4, one of the members became ill. And there's a lot of illness on this journey.
Oh no. Is it like altitude or is it like food or what's going on?
It didn't specify. I assume altitude. Probably.
Yeah. That tends to be the biggest thing is the altitude sickness. And then also, like you get oxygen deprivation at those elevations, and that can also make you very ill.
Yeah.
Mm.
So Junko and several other members escorted the sick member back to Camp 2, but when they got back to Camp 2, there was an avalanche. So in the early hours of May 4th, an avalanche broke free above Camp 2, and several members, including Junko, were injured. The way she describes it in her memoir, like, people were like buried under snow until other team members were able to dig them up. It was really like a terrifying and scary moment for everyone on the team, but luckily no one died. And this is because, do you remember, they set up Camp 2 15 meters away from where the previous year's teams had set up camp. And so that location with all of the garbage where the previous year's teams had encamped took the brute force and the main impact of the avalanche. And so they were actually spared the majority of the impact.
Wow.
Solid. Good move.
Yeah.
Look at all that trash. It's a bad area. We're going to go over here.
Yeah. If you ever see trash on a hike, friends, it's a sign. Don't camp there.
Don't camp there. Two, also probably should pick up some of the trash, take it with you. Just say,
I mean,
yes,
on Everett's, unfortunately, it's like not possible.
Well, we'll get to that actually. First, let's do her ascent. There were a lot of injuries, including Junko. So after the avalanche, many of the team members were unable really to continue walking. I think in her memoir, Junko actually says she could like barely walk for 2 days. So they decided they didn't really decide. They were forced to wait a week to heal and regain strength before making an attempt on the summit. But this was especially dangerous because anyone that knows anything about climbing Everest knows that there's a very narrow and limited climbing window. And so on May 10th, the team announced that because of this limited climbing window and the injuries and illnesses just like running through the team, they would be selecting finalists from the team to make a go for the summit.
Oh, okay.
So of the 14 team members, 3 would be selected to make an attempt on the summit, and Junko was one of them.
I'm sure she's like, I'm going. I don't care who else you pick. I'm going.
Well, actually, Junko was kind of the opposite. She was very humble and modest with her climbing. And at one point she said, like, no, like, it shouldn't be me that's chosen. I'm not the best climber and you should be sending other people. And it was basically at the insistence of every other team member that was like, no, Junko, like, you should go.
That's awesome. Wow.
Mm-hmm. But on May 12th, this team suffered another setback.
No.
Because of illness among the team's Sherpas, a decision was made that only one climber would be attempting the summit.
Oh my God.
And so I assume you can all guess it was Junko. And this is actually when she said like, no, like that, like, and she nominated a different climber. But everyone believed that she was the best climber in the group and the best choice because she had really been the rock and like the support of everyone and taking care of everyone. And so they thought she had the best chance of making it successfully to the peak of Everest. So on May 16th, Junko woke up at dawn to cover the final distance of the summit. And at 12:30 p.m. that day, Junko and her Sherpa Aang Tsering reached the summit of Everest in 6.5 hours.
That's impressive. Yeah. That's fast.
She was the 38th person to summit Everest and the first woman to ever do so. She completed her climb 22 years after Sir Edmund Hillary made the first ascent of Everest.
Wow.
Nice.
So post-Everest, Junko continued to be a climbing sensation. She basically came home and was just like greeted by like people being like, Junko! But
she's a superstar.
Yeah, but she didn't like being in the spotlight. But she continued to climb. And in 1992, she actually went on to be the first woman to complete the 7 summits, which are the highest mountains on each continent, including Antarctica. So she was she was the 19th person overall to achieve this and the first woman to do it.
Man, she just set records all over the place.
Yeah, really though. She actually made a goal apparently of climbing the highest mountain in each country, and by her death she had achieved 70 of these. So she had climbed like 70 highest peaks in different countries.
Did she do Halasan?
I mean, I assume so, probably.
Probably.
Although, technically, Halasan is not the tallest peak in Korea. Technically, it's the one that borders China and South Korea, North Korea. But, like, eh.
Yeah, but they were separated at that point in the 70s and 80s, so.
This is true.
Yeah.
So, she became she remained basically a major figure in the climbing world throughout her life. But she also became a huge activist for environmentalism within the climbing community, and it was because of the trash that she saw on Everest, actually. So on Everest, Junko was dismayed to see that teams were leaving trash along the mountain as they made the climb, and this was because, like, especially the oxygen tanks on the climb, like, once you use the oxygen tanks, they would just sort of be tossed to the side of the trail. And Junko was dismayed by this. She didn't like the idea that future climbers wouldn't be able to experience sort of the same pristine condition of the mountain that the first climber had experienced, and sort of that like pristine beauty of the mountain in its just natural glory. And so she became adamant about climbing without destroying the mountain, and that was sort of like her key thing moving forward. And she became a major force in environmentalism in the climbing community, and she actually organized cleanup climbs, which were dedicated to removing trash and restoring mountains to pristine conditions. And she organized them on mountains, including Everest.
Wow, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm.
There was a video that I watched that was like a bunch of statistics about Everest. And there are more dead bodies and trash on Everest than there are people who have actually successfully climbed it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like appalling the amount of like tonnage of trash and like things that are that are on Everest that are just like, you know, you could have taken the time to leave it at your camp and then pack it down later on, like spend an extra day packing some of the things that you took with you up down afterwards.
Well, and I think that's like one of, at least for me, that was like one of, like, I think her most important contributions to the climbing community was like this idea of like cleanup climbs and like climbing Everest without the goal of summiting, but really like bringing down the trash instead. So she actually went back to school, and in 2000 she completed postgraduate studies at Kyushu University, focusing on the environmental degradation of mountains, including Everest, caused by waste left by climbing groups. And she ended up becoming the director of the Himalayan Adventure Trust of Japan, an organization working at the global level to preserve mountain environments, and spent the rest of her life advocating for the environment.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And then, because she continued to be great, after the Great East Japan earthquake of 2011, she began organizing annual guided excursions of Mount Fuji for school children affected by the disaster.
Aww.
And she actually participated on a lot of these trips. And her last hike, actually, the year of her death, was one of these excursions up Mount Fuji.
Jeez, up until the end, she was still hiking.
Yeah, wow. She was, I want to say, so she passed away in 2016, but she was diagnosed with stomach cancer in 2012. And she continued climbing and hiking all the way up until her last year. Junko believed in the power of the environment to heal and was a major proponent of creating opportunities for children all over to experience the magic of hiking. She passed away in 2016 from stomach cancer, but like I just said, she continued to hike up until her death, and her final hike was one of the Fuji excursions that she organized. By the time of her death, she had written 7 books and was a force within the climbing and environmental communities.
Oh, that's awesome. Definitely the only thing I regret about being in Japan is not hiking Fuji-san.
Oh, gotta go.
And sort of, I guess, like, just to, like, cap it off, to, like, I mean, I really show, like, her impact. In 2019, there was an asteroid named after her. It is asteroid 6877 Tabe. It was named after her. And they also named a mountain range on Pluto after her.
Really cool.
Yeah, because I guess, don't quote me on this, because I might get it wrong, but the mountain ranges in Pluto are named after, I want to say it's people that have made a significant contribution to, it's either like adventuring or environmental activism, one of the two. Yeah, there's a mountain range named Tabe Montes, I think. I tried looking up the pronunciation of the second word, but I couldn't find it.
It's all good.
So, yeah, that's Junko Tabe.
That's so amazing. And, like, it really hit me when you were talking about or describing what she described as her first summit, because, like, I think like every climber kind of has that, like, you know, I remember when I first started hiking and that first ascent, and it's just so difficult because you don't have the lung capacity yet and you don't have the fitness level yet, and you're just kind of like huffing and puffing up the mountain, and in your mind you're just like, this is the worst thing in the planet, why am I doing this? But then you reach the top and you kind of look around, and it's like that feeling, honestly, like, is indescribable.
Yeah,
I think she did a pretty good job, but it's just kind of like, whoa. Yeah. And even every time, like, and it doesn't even have to be that high. I mean, like, of course, like, the higher the mountain, like, the cooler the view. But, like, anytime, like the mountain that I hiked on the weekend was only, like, 300 meters. It wasn't that tall. But, like, it's just, it's still breathtaking. It's incredible. Yeah. And just being in nature and that feeling. And, like, it's seriously addictive.
Yep. I was going to say mountains always take my breath away because I suck at going up the mountain. I will get to the top, but it'll take me a while, and I will huff and puff the entire way up there. But, like, once I get to the top, I'm good. But yeah. Like, I remember as a kid, like, going on hikes, and it was a lot easier when I was younger to hike up. I didn't struggle as much, but like, I still love the rush of being like, when is it going to be over? When am I going to get to the top? And you get there and you look around, and you're just like, holy crap, this is so pretty. I cannot believe how amazingly beautiful, and I can't believe I hiked all of that. Like, I can't believe I pushed through and got all the way up here. Like, it's amazing. No matter how tall or how short the mountain is, it's still always like it still always takes my breath away, even with the joke of, you know, it really literally takes my breath because hiking up.
No, but it's true. Like, it's why, I mean, the three of us have kept coming back to climbing. That moment at the top, I think, is, like you said, Caitlin, beyond words. And Junko does a good job describing it, but you're right. It's almost impossible to put into words.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's like what she said, but also
it's like so much more. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's something that you have to like, yeah, definitely experience at least once. Even if you're not in like, and I think that's really sweet. Like, you know, I think what she was saying that like, you know, being in nature is like healing and then, you know, everyone should participate, like even children and stuff. And I think that that's accurate. And I think that's really true. And it kind of, you know, it breaks my heart whenever friends or students of mine, for example, they're like, oh, I just stayed in my house all day. And I'm like, what? It's a beautiful day. Go outside. Today is gorgeous. Like the air is really clear and the temperature is perfect. It's like great for outdoor activities. And I literally told my students today, I was like, guys, if I were you, I'd be outside. I wouldn't be sitting in this classroom right now.
Right.
Seriously, I told them. they all laughed as if I was telling a joke, but I was like being like, no, really, you should leave.
Go on, get. Yeah, no, there were so many times where I wish I could have like taught my classes outside while I was in South Korea. Just be like,
yeah,
we're gonna go on the roof and like have an experience, or hey, we're gonna go over to this park that's just outside the school, like just across the street, and like, you know, hang out and do something in nature so that we're not stuck in a classroom all day, every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because it really like, because I think Junko felt that way too. Like when you're out there and when you're on the mountain and stuff, you really have like an appreciation for the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the world, for the environment and stuff. And I think it's really important to have that kind of connection with the natural world.
I think it's fun how all three of our women were very impactful, but they're impactful on different areas of like what we represent as a group. Like,
yeah,
we've got the social impact, we've got the you know, feminism impact, and then we've also got like the adventure side as well. So like,
it's yeah,
on point. Look at us go.
Look at us go. And that, yeah, it's surprising that worked out, because we didn't plan that. We just said,
no.
Oh, pick, like, I'm gonna pick a person, you're gonna pick a person, but it's just we all kind of picked different issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't even share like who we picked before, like for
no.
Yeah. We're just like, the girl I picked is awesome, she's so cool, but never said a name or anything like that.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah,
oh man,
it worked out. Okay, so thank you very much for joining us here today. We hope that you enjoyed listening to our stories about important historical women in many different, over many different disciplines, and kind of tackling many different issues. We certainly enjoyed researching it and also listening to each other.
Yeah. And we'll have a blog post that accompanies this, so that if you're interested in reading about any of the women that we've just discussed, we'll have sort of the information we just shared in the podcast in the blog post, and then also further reading that you can do on your own.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. So check us out on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at getoverit. And, you know, we'll see you next time. Sorry. Botched it. Yeah. Oh, well.
You can also go to teamgetoverit.com. That also works.
That's yes. True.
All of those places is fine. And what do we say? Oh, yeah. Like, comment, and subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on.
Well, actually, Apple just changed it. So it's now follow.
Oh, oh. Jesus. Okay. Sorry. Follow us. Hit whatever, yeah, hit whatever button that you have to touch, because it helps us out. It does something with algorithms so that more people can discover our podcast and our content. And anyway, I think we put on a good show.
I certainly find us entertaining, so I don't know why nobody else would.
You're still listening this far into our 5-minute outro. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate all the love.
Thanks.
I'm making a heart shape with my hands for those who can't see it, which is basically everybody.
For those who can't see it, i.e. you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
See ya. That's it for today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in.
And as always, please support this work by subscribing and donating to our cause at www.teamgetoveryit.com.
Donors get access to specific content like stickers, t-shirts, and postcards from our journey.
You can donate for as little as $5, and the benefits build from there.
Go to our website for more info, or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Team Get Over It.
Thanks for listening, and catch us next time on Get Over It.